The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from AAA Go Magazine and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. Keep in mind, these are simply selected for your enjoyment and edification. Well, the Christmas season is officially upon us, so let's start today's journey with a couple of articles reflecting holiday themes. And we're going to begin with Let the Lights Burn for Hanukkah, written by Leah Hughes and published in the November-December 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine. And she begins by saying the eight-day celebration brings together the Jewish community with events throughout the Southeast. And she's talking about not just southeastern North Carolina, but all of North Carolina, as well as other southeastern states, as you'll see. In community centers, houses of worship, and public squares throughout the Southeast, Hanukkah celebrations this year take place in early December. The eight-day Festival of Lights begins this year at sundown on December 2nd and continues until nightfall on December 10th. The holiday commemorates the rededication of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. When the temple's menorah was lit, the flame burned for 8 days despite having only a one-day supply of oil. Traditional celebrations involve lighting menorahs, eating food fried in oil, playing with dreidels, and coming together to rejoice in religious freedom. Now, some of these events that we're going to be reading, just as an insert here, have already occurred, and we'll try to note that as we go through, but some are yet to happen and may still be on your travel itinerary, if you will. Let's start in North Carolina. On Sunday, December the 2nd, the 5th annual Handmade Hanukkah Market took place at Raleigh's Temple Beth Or, where approximately 30 Jewish artisans who sold handmade products. And the items for sale included watercolor paintings, wood-turned pieces, jewelry, pottery, homemade soaps, and baked goods. In Uptown Charlotte, everyone is invited to a special Hanukkah Hoops and Hornets event at the Charlotte Hornets NBA game on December 12, 2018 at the Spectrum Center. And during that game, special shout-outs from players recognize the holiday, and afterward festivities continue with unique fan experiences and Hornets gifts for everyone in attendance. Moving to South Carolina, in front of the State House in Columbia, a giant Christmas tree and a giant menorah both stand tall. The symbols are a testament to our country's freedom to express different religious beliefs. The menorah will be illuminated at the Isidore E. Laurie Memorial Menorah Lighting, which honors the late senator who championed the public celebration of Jewish life. At press time, the date for the menorah lighting had not been determined. In Charleston, Hanukkah in the Square takes place on Sunday, December 9th, and it's become the largest annual Jewish event in the state. The first portion of the event includes bands, children's activities, hamburgers, cotton candy, latkes, and chicken soup. And to conclude the evening, Holocaust survivors light the menorah. In Virginia, the Jewish Community Center of Northern Virginia uses the Hanukkah holiday as a way to go beyond the center's walls and engage with the public. On Wednesday, December the 5th, the organization hosted the community menorah lighting at Mosaic. That's a shopping and entertainment center in Fairfax. Representatives from a variety of synagogues and organizations lit candles on the large outdoor menorah. The event included free live entertainment, dreidels, and sufganiyot, which are donuts, which were given to those who attended. Now, at the Moses Myers House in Norfolk, once home to the city's first permanent Jewish American residence in the late 1700s, Hanukkah decorations include an antique menorah and dreidels. The house's History Speaks lectures in December focus on faith and family, so they go on throughout the month. Then we move to Tennessee. Bernie's Famous Latkes, or potato pancakes, star at the Sunday, December 9th Hanukkah Festival at the Gordon Jewish Community Center in Nashville. The Lacus are just one part of a big family meal, along with live entertainment, photo booths, and children's games. In Knoxville, children are the focus for Menorah Madness, held this year on Sunday, December 9th. This was a community event that sought to help children connect with the Hanukkah holiday and their Jewish faith amid the commotion of the holiday season. The big surprise each year, what material will construct the menorah? Past iterations have included Legos, balloons, and an ice sculpture. Well, now, our final southeastern stop is Georgia. Almost as soon as this year's Hanukkah Bazaar concludes on Sunday, December the 2nd, the Sisterhood at Or Beshalom in Brookhaven near Atlanta started preparing for next year. It takes months to bake the berakos, savory hand pies and sweets, and other pastries. The foods and traditions found at Sephardic synagogue like Or Beshalom are tie back to Spain and the Mediterranean. In addition to food, the bazaar features vendors selling jewelry, artwork, cookware, clothing, and more. On the coast, the Savannah Jewish Educational Alliance introduces the first Oive 5K and post-Hanukkah Bash on Sunday, December the 9th, and that was held as we read today. The post-race celebration was for everyone, not just runners, and included a menorah lighting and prayers by local rabbis. So, there you have some things happening to celebrate Hanukkah, which precedes the Christmas celebration, but I thought you might enjoy hearing that and make plans for next year to pick up one of those interesting events in the southeastern part of our country. Well, North Carolina is host to one of the most unique estates in the country. As writer Virginia Brown reveals, that discovering people, process, and passion behind Biltmore's annual Christmas transformation, it starts well before the Christmas season begins. Her article, called Making Magic, found in the November-December 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine. White banker's boxes, some tattered, others torn, are stacked in various closets and other available storage nooks in America's largest home. They don't seem special, but these boxes contain Christmas magic. A young woman sits on the floor, fluffing bows and examining ornaments. Cranberry sprigs and gilded magnolia leaves are spread out on the floor and tables. It's early October in Asheville's Biltmore Estate, and though planning began just after the previous Christmas and continues through the year, throughout the year, the home's physical holiday transformation begins. Next month, the first of tens of thousands of guests will wind their way through the halls of the manor, taking in the beauty of 55 Christmas trees, exploring lavish art and antiques. And the month she's referring to, of course, is the current one, December. Every tree has unique toppers, including elements such as ribbon, poinsettias, and feathers. During evening candlelight tours, fireplaces will light mantles filled with flowers, ornaments, and ribbons, and poinsettias will fill the estate. Lizzie Borchers oversees the effort. Following the footsteps of longtime Christmas queen, Kathy Barnhart, who retired last year following 40 years heading up Christmas at Biltmore, Borchers, 32, oversees Barnhart's staff, now 25. And it takes that many and then some to decorate the 18,000-acre estate. Completed in 1895, the Biltmore in Asheville, North Carolina, was the country home of George Vanderbilt, grandson of railroad magnate Cornelius Vanderbilt. Open for public touring, the massive estate with its French Renaissance-style chateau was inspired by Vanderbilt's trips abroad. At the time, it was the largest undertaking in residential architecture history and spanned 6 years. The result is 250 rooms filled with the glamour of the Gilded Age, and it's even more impressive at Christmas time. It's so exciting to think about the number of people who come to Biltmore at Christmas, making memories and enjoying the holiday transformation, says Borchers. And if you've not been up there, I'm going to inject this. You really do need to put this on your travel list itinerary, I think. It's quite impressive. And as Borchers continues, the number of eyes that will be set on what the team is creating, what a responsibility. So you can just imagine all the detailed work that goes there. Combining a childhood spent in historic places such as Charleston, South Carolina, and Newport, Rhode Island, with over 15 years' experience in the floral industry, Borchers says the new job blends her love of history and creative floral design. It's incredible the amount of decor that we have to get into the house at Christmas, says Borchers. Guests would be amazed at how we have to tuck boxes away in closets and corners all over the house. So, as we decorate, it's all there. The undertaking is mammoth and methodical. free delivery begins early in the morning in early October. Borcher's team brings the unadorned trees into Biltmore House. By the middle of the month, decorators have reached the first floor and begin working on the breakfast and music rooms, the tapestry gallery, library, and front hall, among others. Vanderbilt loved Christmas, and staff notes that his journals reflect how holidays were centered around traditions and family. Biltmore works to continue those traditions today. Each season takes on a theme, and no 2 years there are the same. We want to give guests a reason to come back year after year to see something new, says Borchers. One element will undoubtedly remain the same, the iconic front lawn tree. Crane operators work to position the 55-foot-tall Norway spruce out of Avery, North Carolina, and surround it with 35 smaller, bright lit trees and shrubs, 70,000 lights in all. The smallest in the house will be a collection of 10-inch trees adorned with crystals enclosed in cloche in Ms. Vanderbilt's bedroom on the second floor. By the 1st of November, the banquet hall tree raising begins. A horse-drawn carriage delivers the 35-foot tree to the front door of the estate. It takes around 50 employees to hoist it up, carry it, and secure it in place. With every aspect of the decorating, it takes a full team effort. Engineers are a critical component of the process, too, helping to move the trees, hang the garland, and run the hundreds of electrical wires inconspicuously throughout the house. In all, around 45,000 lights and 150 candles light the home at Christmas. But it isn't just the house that enjoys a full holiday overhaul. The full estate is adorned and filled with thousands of strands of twinkling lights, luminaries, light pathways. Every aspect of the home and estate is filled with the spirit of the season. To experience the estate like Vanderbilt's guests would have, take the candlelight tour. Carolers and solo musicians add joy to the halls as each room emits a soft, peaceful glow. Boy, that really makes it sound exciting. And I do tell you, the article just begins to give a hint of what it's really like. It's quite special to go up there this time of year. Well, speaking of this time of year, winter officially arrives in less than a couple of weeks. So what better time to check on Northern Exposure, an article written by Ann Farrar in the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. She's an avid trail runner, alpine climber, and coffee fiend, someone after my own heart there. Ann invites us to embark on the ultimate unplugged adventure to Labrador's remote Torngat Mountains National Park, which lives up to its Inukwetut name as a place of spirits. And so we're going to embark, and by the way, the exposure photo that begins the article is just impressive. It covers two pages, this massive river covered on both sides by, I don't know how you would climb either side. I'm sure experienced climbers can figure this one out, but wow, what an impressive sight to see as you arrive. And as she says, there's rhythm in the wilderness. My boat makes a slap, slap, slap sound as it tugs through the silky black water of Saglik Bay. A polar bear huffs while swarming the scattered islets of the off the coast in search of her next meal. The wind sighs and a feathery touch on my cheek. I've ditched the daily tapping of my computer and the confines of my windowless office to travel to one of Canada's wildest places, Torngat Mountains National Park at the northern tip of Labrador. This spare landscape in the nation's most easterly province, and its soothing natural sounds are blessings at the end of a 24-hour journey from my home in Washington, D.C. The trip involved three planes and a boat before I reached base camp, where I was invited to stay as a guest to experience the profound calm of a place open to travelers a mere 2 months a year. Just north of the Arctic tree line, the 3,700-square-mile park is an ancestral home of the Inuit, whose word Torngat means place of spirits. Their semi-nomadic ancestors held a deep connection with the environment, and this land whispers of generations past, thousands of years reflected in the ebb and flow of migration. Inuit cultural guides share stories from their childhood of caribou hunts, polar bear encounters, and dog sledding across open snow-covered land. John Jerarus, an Inuit elder, remembers hunting with husky dogs. He says even in the dark or whiteout conditions, the dogs would always know the way home. They're better than GPS, he says. The clouds hang low, heavy with rain. As we zip through the water on Zodiac boats, I spot a glimmer of white in the distance that flashes like a tooth jutting out of the sea. It doesn't look like much at first, but as we move closer, it dwarfs our boat. The iceberg was calved long ago from western Greenland or the Canadian Arctic and traveled down the coast to dwindle in the summer sun. We unload the boat onto Saglit Bay's sandy North Arm Beach and build a fire as a soft rain falls. We learn that this beach has been used for millennia as a summer retreat, a place for Inuit to commune with family and friends, a place to hunt and fish and gather food for the cold winter to come. After a short hike to view archaeological sites, some of us set about casting lines at the mouth of a river that empties into the arm, where Arctic char amass for an afternoon feast. Our efforts bring in large silvery char, a member of the salmon family. These fish migrate between lakes and salt water to spawn, and their eyes are a prized delicacy for the Inuit, providing needed vitamin C. We pull out our knives and savor deep red sashimi right there on the rocks, the freshest dining experience I've had in years. The next morning, after an aerial tour of the park and its majestic fjords, our helicopter returns to Saglit Bay and lands on Salikuluk, or Rose Island. The island is quiet, but the past echoes loudly there. Archaeological sites on the island stretch back 5,000 years. We walk through tufted grass and over small rocks and come across a hill partly carved away. Years ago, this was a site of homes shared by multiple families. Lines scattered about are whale bones and shards of Rama chert, a fine-grained glass-like stone found only in this region and used by the Inuit for tool-making. We continue on until we reach a mound of large rough rocks, carefully heaped over a sacred burial ground. Underneath lie the bones of more than 100 people. All have been removed from a Salikuluk at one point. Their remains have now been returned and their spirits remembered in words and song by a new generation. Back on the mainland, in the abandoned Inuit community of Hebron, outside the park, German and Inuit names lie side by side in the cemetery. The community was relocated in 1959, leaving homes and the 1830s Moravian Mission Church to fall into disrepair. Craftsmen from the families who once called Hebron home have returned and for more than a decade have been rebuilding the church, a National Historic Site since 1976, brick by brick, board by board. I feel like an astronaut, decked out in orange safety suits that will keep us warm and buoyant in the event of falling overboard. We cruise from island to island off the coast to catch a glimpse of polar bears. Always curious, the bears stop, look at us, in fact, look at us up and down, and then try to figure out if we're a foe or potentially their next meal. Then they go about their business. They dot the landscape of one islet, making it look like a polar bear lounge. Most of them spend the afternoon dozing in the sun. But the most populous living creatures in the area are the mosquitoes, vicious beasts that attack with vigor. After 3 days slathering repellent across every exposed piece of skin, feeling defeated and crazed, I walk into the small camp store and offer every U.S. and Canadian dollar I have to obtain a net jacket complete with full head protection. In the middle of summer, the warm sun makes us sweat, but nights are cold, compelling us to don layers of clothing an inch closer to the campfire. The sky sinks from blue to black as we gravitate to the mess hall. Coffee and brownies are plentiful. We while away the evening, swapping stories, encircled by the camp's 7-foot-high electrified fence that keeps us safe from bears. If we're lucky, the northern lights will dance across the sky and remind us of the spirits that travel these mountains. Ooh, doesn't that make you want to go there? I mean, what a fabulous article that is. Up there in Salikuluk. Nice. Well, with the chilly climb of Labrador and lots of holiday activity already behind us, how about a walk in the park now? Well, that's the title of Robert Reed's article in the October-November 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Reed invites us to follow the glow to grand, graceful Balboa Park, San Diego's remarkable cultural heart. And you won't need a jacket for this. It's that nice, balmy California weather that you can expect. I don't know how many cities employ their own pipe organist, but I know the new organist in San Diego has flair. Raul Prieto Ramirez is wearing bright red pants, a magenta shirt, and high-heeled white shoes. In other words, you can't miss him. A 40-year-old Spaniard, Ramirez gets to play the world's largest outdoor pipe organ. The shoes are for its many pedals, which is ensconced in the century-old Spreckles Organ Pavilion, one of various architectural wonders that dot Balboa Park. At this moment, he's considering what special effects to use at his upcoming free concerts. It will cover the whole thing in fog, he says. A bolt of energy from Barcelona, Ramirez brings a new dynamic to San Diego's art scene. Every Sunday at 2 p.m., he performs an hour of harmonic hits from memory, finishing a 17th century composition or Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. He spins around his bench, springs to his feet, and bows to a crowd of 800 or more. His goal, he tells me, is to jolt audiences out of reality and into a more connected sense of self, particularly young San Diegans. It's what music's for, he says. Ramirez could not have picked a more opportune spot. Balboa Park, named for Spanish explorer and conquistador Vasco Núñez de Balboa, is celebrating its 150th birthday this year by stepping out of the shadow cast by such celebrated greenswords as San Francisco's Presidio and Boston's considerably smaller Common. Climb the seven stories of the Museum of Man's California Tower, which doubled as Xanadu in the 1941 film Citizen Kane, and you will gaze out over some 1,200 acres spread across three parallel mesas. Bikers, joggers, and downward doggers crowd the landscape. Look for the century-old Morton Bay fig tree, trunk girth more than 490 feet, then swivel to take in the San Diego Zoo, home to clouded leopards and other vulnerable species. Walk Balboa Park's paths and you'll encounter the bronze statue of Castilian nobleman El Cid, south of the San Diego Museum of Art. The museum is one of 17 cultural institutions here, many housed in Spanish colonial palaces built in 1915 and 1916. When Balboa Park hosted the epic Panama-California Exposition, drawing more than 2 million to celebrate what became a coming-out party for the park and the growing city of 50,000. Other more recent museums include the San Diego Automotive Museum and the forthcoming Comic-Con. Hello, Spidey, Leah, Mr. Spock, that's in parentheses. I've come to find out how Wonder Woman will fit into what serves as the West Coast Central Park. Entering the premises by Cabrillo Bridge feels like stepping back into time in Seville, Spain. Ornamented towers and mosaic domes bask in sunshine. Arched walkways lead to hidden Moorish gardens. Stucco reliefs of famed Spaniards line the walls of El Prado, a promenade of more than a dozen buildings erected for the 1915 exposition, some of which weren't intended to be permanent. Lobbying by locals, however, has encouraged the city to invest millions to preserve them. The El Prado Complex is a top attraction along with San Diego Zoo, acclaimed for its pioneering conservation programs. But as I explore the farther reaches of this expanse of steep mesa valleys, hiking trails, gardens, and dog parks, I discover plants and trees, orchids, palms, bonsai, cacti from six continents. Organic remnants of a century-old bravado that demonstrates how pretty much anything can grow in San Diego. Teenagers on scooters zip by ornamental fountains while family picnics play out on manicured lawns bordering reflecting pools. I gravitate to the intricate facade of the San Diego Museum of Art, established in 1925 and modeled on Spanish plaxiarist architecture. DJ parties occasionally take over its high-ceilinged walls, but this Wednesday evening, the action will be in its courtyard restaurant, Panama 66. I join the scene of patrons sipping craft beer and eating grilled panini as a quintet of teens plays Freddie Hubbard songs from the early 1960s. The music's good, like really good. Best is 13-year-old John Murray, who wears a slick gray suit and without looking plucks the strings of an upright bass considerably taller than he is. Within minutes, an adult joins the teens with a powerful blast of trumpet, his black hair combed straight back. Gilbert Castellanos is a San Diego jazz icon who created the Young Lions Jazz Conservatory in 2000. 2017 and host these free-form jazz nights. After the teens wrap up their set, Castellanos moves the show indoors to the James S. Copley Auditorium with his adult quartet. The 300-plus seats are filled mostly with 20-somethings tuning in to Castellanos' riffs on jazz from the 1950s and 60s. I'm impressed. The next morning, I spring for a multi-day explorer pass, $59, to pop into as many of the park's museums as I can. At the Automotive Museum, I see a motorcycle that stuntman Evel Knievel revved up in the 1977 film Viva Knievel. I browse little magazines filled with quirky 1950s art at the San Diego History Center. And in the Museum of Man, I read placeholders explaining that missing baskets and pots have been decolonized to San Diego's original inhabitants, the Cumayá. My favorite is the San Diego Natural History Museum, which won the museum's world equivalent of an Oscar in 2016. I see why at the Coast to Cactus in Southern California exhibit, where I pause on a bench near a tent. Within minutes, the silhouettes of two children appear, projected on the tent. As wildlife images and sounds scroll past, one of the silhouettes asks, "What was that?" The second answers, "Silencio, here, near the border with Mexico." No translations are offered, nor needed. Ambling beyond El Prado, I check out cacti, ocotillo, and agave plants at the Desert Garden, then arrive at a barrel-shaped former water tower converted in 1996 into the World Beat Cultural Center. It shouts its existence with colorful murals that represent indigenous figures around the world. I've come for lunch and to beat the drum. At the World Beat Cafe, I order an African vegan curry, then take in an exhibit devoted to Afrofuturism, inspired by the film Black Panther. Word is circulating that an African drum class, one of several classes held here, is about to begin. Before I know it, Ghana-educated teacher Nana Yaw Esidu hands me a djembe, a West African goblet drum, which he tells me to play by tilting it so each hit of my palm resounds to its open bottom. Asidu's colorful robe, like Ghanaian attire, delights my fellow students, who are mostly preteens and regulars. We play several songs. I stumble with the 7/8 time signature. The final song is led perfectly by the 12-year-old onto my left. Later, Asidu tells me, "We get business types here. They say the drums are for them are transformative, like therapy." The following day takes me to the sloping Florida Canyon between the park's central and east mesas. Balboa Park may be famed for its lush vegetation, but here you see what the land originally looked like, all coastal sagebrush and chaparrals of scrubby oaks. I walk a mile, pausing at cactus blooms, and to let a lizard pass before arriving at the Spanish Village Art Center, a 1930s collection of stucco cottages near El Prado. Organized around a courtyard made of tiles painted salmon pink to mint green, the cottages house 37 art studios and galleries. Purple blooms pop from the jacaranda trees beyond eucalyptus trees, peeking over an arched entryway. I meet with Michelle Gonzalez, who has a studio here, for a watercolor class. This is my first experience with watercolors, and she's got a suggestion. "Just do shapes," she says, "no lines." I make a clumsy go of replicating the tree-filled scene with daubs of yellow, green, brown, and orange. Primitive, she deadpans, but good. Touting my artwork, I head to the Prado at Bilbao Park restaurant, where I order a Kobe beef sushi. And that ends our journey today on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it, that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, direct them, please, to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.